Welcome back to Hashtag Black. This is the podcast that we have designed where we get to hash out the hashtags that frame Black life. My name is Dr. Stephanie Shanakan. I teach at the University of Missouri in the Department of Black Studies and the School of Music, and I chair the Department of Black Studies. Really thrilled to continue to work on this show with my students. And today I have three of my favorites. They are Marshall Allen, Deja Mackey, and Ida Campbell-Jones. So quick round the table. Marshall, your major, and that's all.
Marshall Allen, double major in political science and Black studies.
Deja
Mackey, majoring in Black studies, minoring in women's and gender studies.
Ida Campbell-Jones, majoring in Black studies.
So this week, just looking around our table, and we are all exhausted. We are all really tired from the week that we've just had. And so we have a couple of really big hashtags that I'd like us to talk about. And then, as usual, towards the end of our show, we're going to go around and talk about the hashtags that individually we are looking through. So these two are the big ones. And I'm going to go in chronological order. So the first one I'd like us to talk about is hashtag Jemele Hill. And this, of course, is a hashtag that started trending around September 11th. And it concerns a reporter, an ESPN reporter, who went on Twitter and talked about Donald Trump and said that, quote, he's unqualified and unfit to be president. She also said that he was a white supremacist who surrounded himself with other white supremacists. Now, this was her personal tweets. What has been interesting for us is that ESPN, whether they supported her or not, what are your feelings about that? And also, the response from the White House has been quite illuminating. So let me start with, I'll start with Deja this time. Deja, hashtag Jemele Hill.
Yeah, so I just think it's very interesting what I remember, what comes to mind when I think about people of color who have platforms, especially on Twitter. This reminded me of, I don't remember her name, but L'Oreal, they booked a trans woman, a Black trans woman. Oh, I cannot remember her name. Can you look? Okay, thank you. And she also spoke out about pretty much saying the exact same things. It was in response to Charlottesville. But anytime a Black person with a platform, whether they be a reporter, an actress, a model, whatever, when they attempt to speak out and use their platform, which is what those who are trying to eradicate injustices say that you should do, when you have a platform, you use it to speak on issues that are important to you. When they attempt to use that platform, they're vilified for it. It's ridiculous to me. I mean, with the hashtags that we're gonna talk about in a second, it's just exhaustion. Like, I remember I watched a video of her, and she was saying, I'm a reporter. Am I not supposed to report these things? I mean, when Colin Kaepernick, when he kneels, am I supposed to pretend like that didn't happen? I'm a journalist. That's what I do. So she's doing her job.
Right. Right. Okay. Ida.
Basically, like what Deja said, like when people have these platforms, especially through social media, which is one of the most like accessible news outlets, they're criticized when they speak on the truth that people don't want to hear. And what I find really interesting is that ESPN tried to replace her secretively with other Black sports journalists that tried to replace her. And the people that tried to replace her with refused to do it.
And they tried to replace her with other black journalists,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. But they're both black males. Mm-hmm. And they refused to do it without her, or they're like, if you don't, like, stand with her, then we're not going to be
right.
on this show.
Mm-hmm.
I found that, like, most interesting with this story, because when it comes to black women in, like, leadership and in the media and, like, in general, their black unity is really important. And it's really important that we do, like, stand with each other and make sure that we're not, like, left behind or swept under the rug.
Right, right. And one of the things that I found interesting just this morning, I woke up and saw the news story about Jay-Z. He has decided not to accept the invitation to sing at the NFL.
I did see that.
What's the big show they
do? The Super Bowl?
The Super Bowl. He's decided not to sing at the Super Bowl, which I think speaks volumes for the type of unity that Ida is talking about. Okay, Marshall.
So, first, I'd like to comment on Bill Simmons. He was recently, fired a while ago. He had a show, he was known as the Boston Sports Guy. So it was pretty interesting because he had a high respect for her and pretty much showed a strong allyship toward her as far as what she said. He called somebody on his show a liar. His bosses didn't like that, found some way to get him out. So I thought that was interesting that he really did come to her aid. And I was reading an article from Washington Post. A Bendari Alexander said that if Hill was fired, it actually violates Connecticut law, which protects employees from retaliation for any First Amendment speech. And so Jameel Hill is really interesting because the majority of this is surrounded around free speech and how people interpret that based off of radio waves or Twitter and stuff like that. Something else that was interesting too was Sarah Huckabee. And her response, and I was reading an article on Rolling Out, and it actually said that according to federal law, Title 18 of the U.S. Code, government employees are prohibited from influencing the employment decisions or practices of a private entity or company solely on the basis of partisan political affiliation. And so that just shows, too, how free speech is connected. Like, when you think about, like, constitutional liberties and stuff like that, that free speech, being in the Constitution, being a right, free speech does not mean, for the most part, you can say whatever you want, right? There are limits to free speech. The government does, in fact, limit free speech, how you say it, how you express yourself, et cetera, et cetera. And these are examples, you know what I'm saying, based off of constitutionality, you know what I'm saying, based off of law, both federal and state, you know, that have regulations actually protecting, right, Jameel Hill for what she said. But just like Ida said, when any time it is a dissenting opinion or something that goes against what the masses of people are thinking, right? We always try to find ways, you know, to put those pot shots in there,
right.
Especially when she expressed that she was using her personal beliefs, right? And then we see this something as like historic too. For instance, Brandenburg versus Ohio, 1969. Brandenburg was a leader of the KKK, got up and said, you know, I want the N-words to go back to Africa, the Jews to go back to Israel. We're not a revengeant organization, but some revengeance will be taken if our government continues to suppress the white male race, blah, 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 blah. Long story short, the Supreme Court saw that as free speech, in essence, right? Regardless of how threatening it was, how publicly demeaning it was, right, or the history of the organization's violent, sadistic past, right?
Mm-hmm.
So using cases like that, it would be, you know, nonsensical for Jameel Hill to be fired or removed for saying something as simple as, you know, Donald Trump is XYZ, And then historically, cases that do the exact same thing with different colored people, mm-hmm. right, don't hold up. So
interestingly, I mean, I love that you bring in the 1969 case and speak to the historical precedents. But even recently, you know, if we look back at what some of the things that the president has said recently about different things and different people. Again, what is free speech? What gets called out? Also, recently, the contestant for Miss America,
Miss Texas,
she really came out strong and said some really pointed things.
But the issue with Miss Texas that people are calling on technicality is that she never expressly said Donald Trump is a white supremacist. Okay. She said the white supremacist issue was a terrorist attack, and Trump should have done better fixing the issue. And so people are calling that as a technicality, even though in context, you know, the masses understood what she was saying. And she said this at a pageant, which is one patriarchal, right, reinforces heterosexism, reinforces gender roles and
Trump's
stuff like
pageant.
That.
Also, as Marshall said, Bill Simmons, who came out really strong in support of Jemele Hill, is a white journalist. And again, I want to point out back to what Ida said about unity and allyship. And so as we move forward, we're looking to see how this type of unity and allyship will grow, because I think we need it, particularly in the age of recently hashtag Anthony Lamar Smith and what is happening in St. Louis. So as we know, on September 15th, on Friday morning, we got the news that the verdict had come out. But the day before that, we had heard that the governor of our state, the state of Missouri, had ordered the National Guard in anticipation of the verdict. So when we saw that, a lot of us anticipated what the verdict was going to be. And indeed, we were not surprised. So let's talk about that hashtag, hashtag Anthony Lamar Smith. I prefer to call it that rather than hashtag the name of the officer who has just been found not guilty, because we need to call out these names of black people who have been killed. So, Ida.
Like, bringing the killer cops to court and acting like they're going to indict him and actually not, I feel like that's a conspiracy in itself, because they want black people and people that are fighting for justice to be angry. They want us to retaliate. They want us to look bad in the media. And that's their agenda to me. I feel like it's all just a game at this point to see how far they can take us. And I feel like I've just been numb to the literal situations. And I don't really know at this point how to react, except for I'm not surprised. And I'm more so just nervous for the strength of my city and how we're going to, like, bounce back from this, because the city is worse than it was when Mike Brown was murdered, and because we're fed up. And we're hurt, because it's like, you saw what happened last time. There's even more proof than when Mike Brown was murdered. And my sister even called, my sister in Chicago, she was like, whenever you go home, just don't go home this weekend. Oh. Like, we can't go home, because I don't even know what I'm going home to.
Right. All right, so let's go to Marshall.
So the first thing that I noted was that, you know, this was, the actual murder happened December 20th, 2011. Mm-hmm. That shocked me. That it's taken 6 years for it to finally come to the public, for it finally to be something worth noting. Second thing that I thought was interesting, I was reading the New York Daily, right? Ben Trachtenberg, he's an MU law professor here, and he said that, just paraphrase, of course, but people will be arguing about the conclusion from evidence and probably less about the law. So my question was, what's the law?
Can you repeat that?
He said, this is a paraphrase, people will be arguing about the conclusion from evidence and probably less about the law. So when people talk about it, they'll be arguing about the evidence that was found, the conclusion the judge made, but less about the law surrounding it all. But my question was, what's the law? What's the law, you know, that we're looking at, that we're facing, if there's one at all? Like, what is it? I read the article, read other articles. I didn't see any things about law in there. And I was, you know, I really wanted to find out, you know, what it was.
Yeah,
you know?
And I'm curious about whether the evidence is not connected to the law, right?
You know,
right.
And that was, you know, it just, it shocked me. Not and shocked me, but I was just...
Ben Trachtenberg is a colleague, and we may ask him to weigh in on this at some point. That would be interesting.
But yeah, so we know the stories. Like, it's like the specifics, right? Killed 6 inches from the body, shot 5 times, 1 in the neck, which makes no sense to me, but whatever. So something like some meaningful quotes. So like, the defense has argued the former officer's comment, right, was taken out of context because he was frustrated.
And what's the comment? Excuse me?
So he said, it was reported that he said on police dash cam.
As he was chasing,
I'm going to kill this MF. Don't you know it? Also, Anthony Lamar Smith was shot 5 times. But the article in STL Today reported that there was an initial 7 shots in the parking lot before he'd left. The police dash cam also shows the officer with his personal, the article made sure to emphasize personal, AK-47 outside up against his window. And so we talk about tweets, and out of all the tweets that I was reading, I read this one tweet which really, really, really took an impact, and her name was Kayla Reed, and she said, Missouri's paying thousands to occupy STL with the National Guard in fear of black rage versus changing the law to value black life.
Shout out to Kayla Reed. That's my sis.
Hashtag Anthony Lamar Smith.
Mm. Powerful. Powerful. So also that the National Guard was called out, but they were not called out in Charlottesville.
Mm-mm.
Again.
That was free speech.
Thinking about the balance of
they
of
were in Charlottesville, value. Just not as the National Guard.
Yeah, just not as the National Guard.
That's some tea.
Ida Campbell.
Oh.
Deja. Hashtag Anthony Lamar Smith.
Yes. A couple of questions that I have. Is it legal for a police officer to carry their personal weapons in their vehicle?
That's against
the law.
It's against the law.
The law. Doing something that's against the law. Wow.
So we'd like
obviously
to ask
I
Ben
need an answer to that question,
about that.
But yeah, Ben, I would like some receipts.
I legitimately want to know, because I was so reading his comment or his critique, I was lost. I really didn't know where to start or where to even begin researching. You know, how to find that out. You know, then like looking at some of the evidence, right, where it's like there was a revolver. He went into his duffel bag for a period of time, which is shown on the dash cam, and then he came back at, you know, at some point in time, and then sat in the car. I mean, the car's evidence, right? Like, your DNA now is tainting the evidence. You just sit in the car, and then, well, now we find a revolver with bullets not in it.
And only whoever, what's the officer's name? It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Only his DNA is on the gun that's planted. Mm-hmm.
Only his DNA is on the trigger. So, like, when you I watched a lot of CSI as a child. But, like, when you do the little, the gun residue test, like, they wipe it right in between your pointer finger and your thumb where you hold the gun. His DNA was not only the only DNA found on the gun, but in that position. So, like, what more can we give you other than him saying, I killed him, which he basically did? Like, it is premeditated, right, and on film.
And so the judge's ruling was, and I think this is what Ben Trachtenberg may have been pointing to, was that there was not sufficient evidence to prove that the police officer killed Anthony Lamar Smith premeditated in cold blood. There was not sufficient evidence. And I guess that's the bottom line of what the law is looking for now. The four of us sitting here understanding the context, right, and the long trajectory of these Black men and women being killed, and we can mention many hashtags. We take all of that into consideration. We're all scholars, and we put this, we set this case in the midst of that, and we tend to believe that the evidence is so clear. Particularly, I think, of interest is that the judge said something about Anthony Lamar Smith's identity as an urban
heroin dealer.
Mm-hmm. And so there's no evidence that this urban heroin dealer was carrying a gun, yet the judge gets to make that claim and take his beliefs and his history into the ruling.
No. And that was the next thing I wanted to bring up, that a lot of times when we see these Black victims killed by the hands of police, the first thing that's brought up is their criminal past, if a criminal past at all. You know, pulling out every negative thing that's ever happened in every time period of their lives in an effort to reason or justify, well, yeah, he died, but it's a good thing that he died. We have one less bad person on the street.
Okay, so this is something we'll keep following. St. Louis is still... is still hot, and there's so much tension. So we'll probably talk about this again. Deja had something to say.
Just a couple of things that I wrote down in the notes on my phone while we've been speaking. The public reaction to all of this in St. Louis. So, like, when I say public reaction, I'm referring to the people that went out and demonstrated, the people, just what I've been seeing on Facebook out of, like, people that I personally know, and just the police, the way that they are, it's not, you would think that Greitens doing what he did with setting up, you know, the barricades and sending out the National Guard before the actual verdict was given was proactive. But it's not. It's reactive. Because if I were to say anything was proactive, which is nothing that they did, that would mean you going back and addressing the laws in the way that they're created, or something to where this man would not have been murdered. The way that you train your police, the way that you vet your police when you hire them, who are they? What is their past? What is their bias? And obviously nothing that was done was proactive. So that would in turn make everything that you do reactive. And just some of the things that I've seen, people that I know describing their experiences demonstrating in St. Louis as a drive-by of pepper spray and rubber bullets as they're walking away. Videos of people being just standing there and being trampled and arrested and criminalized for
sometimes
literally standing there.
On their own property.
Yes, just watching. And something that striked me most was the police mocking the demonstrators and after they arrested them, saying, chanting, whose streets, our streets, whose streets, our streets. That, I don't need to go into that and explain that, because if you don't understand the context of that, you are missing something greatly.
It's a literal definition of a police state.
You are missing something greatly.
And it's chilling.
Yes.
It's really chilling.
But that's not the first time this happened either, though. Right after the murder of Eric Garner, we had three of NYPD's finest in shirts that said, "We can breathe."
Wow.
You know.
Wow.
But
one last thing that I wanted to bring up, in a class that I was in, shout out to Dr. Elman, Feminist Media Studies.
Julie Elman.
Yes. Wonderful professor. We've been talking about this in all of my classes, just because all my classes except for that one are Black Studies classes. But Dr. Elman brought it up, and that class is predominantly white women. They're about maybe max six women of color, about four Black women. We spoke about it, and something that I mentioned in that class was, because it's a media studies class, so we're focusing on the media's lens on it and how, you know, the bias in the media, and we're talking about how the video of the white woman, like the elderly white woman being tackled and arrested, is like the thing that's going viral that everyone's seen. And my comment in that class was, what do white people need to be doing, and what are the conversations that white people need to be having? Because I'm not saying that to call everyone to be prison abolitionist. I mean, eventually I am. That would be the goal, the end goal. But what are, like, y'all need to be having these conversations, because as Ida said, we're exhausted. We, how many people are going to have to literally be murdered and have it on tape? The next thing is for someone to be murdered and the whole thing is on. I mean, we have that. Philando Castile, we have that.
It's been done. Mm-hmm.
We have everything. What more do we need to show you? What more do your people need to do for you to understand that something's got to give?
Right, right. We have so much more to say about this, but our time is running out and you all have to get to class. So we're going to go mm-hmm. around and talk about what the other hashtags are that we're following. Marshall.
So the first one that I had was Drawing While Black. It was created by a woman named Annabelle. She says, hi, my name is Annabelle. I'm a first-generation Ghanaian-American animator and illustrator. I'm also the organizer of Drawing While Black. Each tweet of anybody posted the hashtag is automatically 20,000 likes, 20,000 retweets, stuff like that. Just simple stuff like black people showing talent, right, creativity, unity, you know, outside of the angry narrative, right? Just fantastic.
Ida, real quick.
So I just found this hashtag, and I really like it because it's really cute. It's called Wednesday Wisdom, and it's a lot of people just, like, saying, like, inspirational things, especially because it's the morning. It's, like, motivational stuff. Like, I just saw one that said, it's kind of funny, maybe eating a donut wasn't cheating on my diet. Maybe going on a diet was cheating on my donuts. And then another one, like, she's an old soul craving new adventures. So it's just, like, really cute.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah.
And hopefully we around this table are dropping some Wednesday wisdom as well. Mm-hmm. So we should hashtag that. Thank you, Ida. Deja.
Yes. Yeah, so mine isn't a hashtag. It's a shout out to two black women that I follow on Instagram that y'all should too. The first, her name is Valencia D. Clay. So her handle is Valencia_Valencia. It's spelled V-A-L-E-N-C-I-A. And the second one, her name is Brandy Chantal. It's just all lowercase. B-R-A-N-D-I-C-H-A-N-T-A. LLE. So they're both black women who are educators. And I follow them. I've been following them for about a year now. and Valencia, she has published, I think they both teach high school. She has published a book of her students' writings. And they're both just women that I hope to be an educator one day. And the way that they infuse, like, current events going on in black life and, like, black music, like, they'll change the lyrics to Bodak Yellow and, like, put it in their curriculum, and, like, just the way that they make their curriculums and their syllabi so accessible to people. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful to me. And, like, they post videos of their students, and, like, because the education system and the experience of education is so vastly different for black students than it is for white students. And just for them to give their students, like, the lens and their platform of social media is so powerful to me. And I could talk about them both forever, but you have to follow them to know what I mean.
2 seconds. Hashtag Fenty Beauty and hashtag Bodak Yellow, because
yes.
Cardi B and Rihanna are definitely killing the game. And
okay, yes. So we should bring
women.
Those two up, because I have some questions about the whole spending so much money on Fenty Beauty. Yes, but we can talk about that. We'll get around to it. Mine would be hashtag self-care, and I want to give a shout out to Deja Mackey for creating a really wonderful playlist for us that really helps us get through this season of trauma, this renewed season of trauma that we're going through. We're on SoundCloud.
I would also encourage you to follow me on Spotify for other playlists. Yes.
Deja Mackey.
I'm a playlist
Spotify.
Connoisseur.
Okay. Wonderful. Yes. We love the black music. Yeah. I study it every day. All right. So thank you for listening. We look forward to hearing from our listeners, and please share this with others. We need to continue thinking about and talking about all these hashtags that frame black life. Thank you. See you next time.